of the Hagman Report. We're going to be joined by Jack Morfonius in just a few moments. He has the YouTube channel End Times News Report. And it's actually, I didn't know he was going to be coming. I didn't know this was the same guy who had that YouTube channel. I've been talking about his videos on The Daily Show for a few weeks now. He's done some real in-depth investigative journalism into more of the background information of Stephen Paddock, the Las Vegas shooter. And we're going to be getting into that with him in just a few moments when he joins us. But I first want to bring you a word from Greenovative. We have a huge sale that Greenovative has been, that we've had this sale since Thanksgiving. It was the Black Friday sale that has been extended, and Greenovative is continuing their huge 30% discount sale. You can take 30% off of the entire store. All you need to do is use the discount code Hagman. And this is a sale specifically for all the loyal Hagman listeners, and this is the perfect time to buy any of the gifts at Greenovative. They make power, portable power that makes power anytime, anywhere, in any weather, day or night, with their rechargeable battery systems. Again, it's 30% off all items in the store using promo code Hagman. And you can contact Alan Riggs at Greenovative if you have any questions. Now, before we get to Jake, I want to say Morpheus, because on the Matrix, that is the character's name on the Matrix.
It's Morfonius.
Morfonius. But, we were joking before the show that I'm gonna screw it up and say Morpheus. But, no, Morfonius. Again, his website is, his YouTube channel is End Times News Report. And he has a lot
He's on Twitter too, at Morfonius.
Yeah. And we're gonna get into, a number of issues that have been in the news, from what has been going on in Saudi Arabia. He has some insights into Blackwater mercenaries on the ground in Saudi Arabia torturing some of the Saudi princes who were rounded up in the anti-corruption scandal. We're going to get into that.
Man, I think you can guarantee. I really think you could almost get that can be guaranteed.
And
subcontract.
Censorship.
Yeah. Look, I subcontract all my torture needs out.
Well, I have a question.
It's just what I do.
What information are they trying to see? There's different theories on this. Some are saying that if you follow that QAnon stuff, that this is to extract information about the Hillary Clinton criminal cabal. Others are saying that they're trying to stomp out
what
any
do you mean follow it. You mean buy into it?
No, to figure it out and to expose it. This is what this goes on with those sealed indictments claims and Marine Langley claims.
Okay, I look at it simply as all I do is I look at it as just kind of a piece of information out there. You can't vet that information,
right?
Because how can you?
What are the possibilities?
Look, there are a lot of people who want to waste a lot of our time. And you know what? You can select any number of rabbit holes. And I'll tell you something. this was a trick that used to be back in the day. You could have somebody chasing their tail for a long time if you knew what you were doing and how to do it. And I see this happening with many people where somebody will be chasing their tail on things like this, and it's a method to keep someone occupied. So just keep that in the back of your mind.
Well, we have our guest with us, Jack Morfonius, and Jack, our technician says that you don't have your video turned
Jake.
On. Jake, I'm sorry. Jake.
Again.
What did I say, Jack?
Yeah. Well, let's see. Let's see how many times we screw this up.
It's one of those days. No, our tech Eric says that your video is not turned on. If you could turn that on, we would appreciate it. Now, Jake grew up in a political family in Miami, Florida, and was involved in political campaigning from his childhood. His grandfather was a Pulitzer-nominated investigative journalist who exposed mafia activity and political corruption. I'm going to just bring Jake on and let him get into, let him tell you about his background. Jake, welcome to the Hagman Report.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing fantastic.
We got to check. Let me check. All right. Yeah, I guess we're all right.
It's great to have you on. I was just telling our audience that I've been following your YouTube channel. I just subscribed to it last month, and I didn't even know you were coming on until about an hour or two before the show. I didn't make the connection. And I just got to say, great work, especially on some of your investigations into Stephen Paddock. I want to get into that after you come on and introduce yourself. But tell our audience a little bit about yourself.
Sure, thank you. Well, listen, great to be on the show with you guys. You do excellent work. Let me give you, I guess, a real quick synopsis. I grew up in a political family. My grandmother was an elected official. My grandfather used to run. He was the chief of staff for a senator and congressman down in Florida. My dad used to work with some of the Bushes down there in Florida, Jeb, and worked on the campaign for HW, things like that. And very diverse. My grandfather was liberal. He was a state campaign chairman for Lyndon Johnson during his presidential bid. My grandmother was so conservative. She used to host Rush Limbaugh's show. And so very, very diverse background as far as the political philosophy that I grew up with. I'm much more libertarian than any of them. Well, as an adult, I kind of followed in the family footsteps. I became a political strategist, operative. I was the campaign chairman here in North Carolina for Steve Forbes when he ran in 2000. And I was a writer for the Ron Paul campaign for his 08 and 12 presidential bids. So a lot of work with state level candidates, but as far as what actually paid the bills, that was just, you know, unless you're going to live in D.C. and work full time as an operative, which I just couldn't stomach the D.C. culture, so I couldn't do that. So what I did was I worked as an investigator over the years in a couple different fields, including financial crimes investigation for a Fortune 100 bank. Working on money laundering, terrorism, money being moved to, laundering money to
now we're talking
terrorist-related charities, things like that. Lots of financial crimes-related stuff. In 2012, I really had been dreading working in the corporate world for a while by that point. So I just said, I can't do this anymore, and I left the company and just went into business for myself, and doesn't pay as well, but I love it. And so what I do is just kind of freelance investigative work related to big stories going on. Mostly geopolitical activities in the Middle East is kind of my forte, but I've taken that and applied the work that I did to a whole lot of stuff with sex trafficking, pedophile rings here in the United States that traffic kids into Eastern Europe. But the last couple of months, I've just been completely consumed with one story, and that is the Las Vegas shooting. So that's wow. Really what I've been working on.
All right. Well, I'm waiting with bated breath here to hear what you've got to say about Vegas. I know Joe's been following your work on that. Go ahead,
yeah,
Joe.
The last video I watched of yours on Stephen Paddock was a video you did. I believe it was of a town called Provo, Utah, and a connection in a car that Paddock apparently owned with another man who was arrested for some kind of drug dealing through a pharmacy he owned. And I found that to be very interesting. And that's where I haven't watched any of your videos since that one.
Okay, but let's not go too far because we have an hour with you. I'd like to do, if we can do this, first of all, is the topic of Vegas okay for...
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So why don't we do this? We're what? 2 months out? 2 months after the event? We don't know anything. At least from the vantage point of the FBI and the LVMPD, they haven't released squat about motive, about the means even, or anything. So why don't you just walk us through what we do know, and wherever trail you want to go down. We're just going to let you go and walk us through this whole mess.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So of course, anyone who follows this, YouTube community or anything online with regard to the Vegas investigation, what we know for sure is that there's rampant speculation. Lots of people have got different theories, and these are great because, you know, it kind of speculation starts us looking down a certain avenue and follow it. If it pans out, excellent. We keep going with it. If it doesn't, we debunk it, set it aside, and move on. Unfortunately, there's a whole lot of resistance to letting go of pet theories out there when they just don't fit anymore. So what I do is a combination of debunking things that are just not accurate and then confirming to the extent we can what is accurate. So we started out with this hearing, of course, that idea that this was a lone gunman, lone wolf shooter is what Sheriff Lombardo told us. Before the police had even stood down while they were still hunting for shooter, the sheriff was already out there saying, any reports of multiple gunmen, it's just not true. So one thing I could say for sure is that the police did believe that there were multiple shooters. The PR statements to the contrary are just that. It's the story you tell the public. Sheriff Lombardo alluded to that by saying, you know, we don't want the public to panic. I think there's a whole lot more reason that he doesn't want to talk about it than that. But let's talk about what we do know. For example, I've put out on my YouTube channel actual video of a number of people, talking about in the hundreds, that were inside of the Mandalay Bay at the time that the shooting was going on. When the shooting is going on, let's say up at the 32nd floor there, after that was all said and done, and Stephen Paddock had allegedly shot himself and we were done, Lombardo was out there saying, no more, this is it. And yet, what was happening inside, and the video evidence we have shows this, is that the police continued hunting for gunmen inside the Mandalay Bay complex for hours after it was over. And the video that I put up, footage from people that were there, these are Mandalay Bay employees, well, kind of the shops there. For the viewers that don't know how this is set up, you've got the Mandalay Bay Hotel, and then kind of back here you have the Delano Hotel. In between these two hotels is a series, it's two stories, it's a complex of shopping, stores, everything from flip-flops to restaurants, that you can go in there. And also in there is, on the first floor, there's the casino, and that's kind of between the two hotels. And then right next to the casino inside this complex is a great big theater called the Michael Jackson One Theater. Well, what started happening was sources started sending me information saying, we were there, there were gunshots inside the casino. We heard them. You could smell the smoke. And this is from multiple sources, independent of each other, saying that they smelled a very distinct odor of gunpowder. Someone sent me a video that I watched of them approaching from the Delano side, approaching toward the Mandalay Bay Casino. There's a small corridor that goes between the Delano Hotel and into that casino complex. There are a couple different people actually that caught video footage. One of them was a fellow that did a Periscope video, kind of live streamed that, and he got to a certain point. And then there was another man that was even up closer. What you see in these videos is as they're going toward the casino, you hear pop, pop, pop. You hear a number of gunshots. The video shows a SWAT team, and this is part of the footage that I didn't put out, the SWAT team moving forward. You can hear them in the other video that I did put out screaming, run, get out of here, run. Laura Loomer had released a little footage a while back showing a man laying face down in that exact spot where this popping sound is heard. Person face down, can't tell if they're dead or alive or. But what has come out since then is footage from employees that were in some of these shops around this area while this was going on. One is from a young woman who was the only person in her store, and she says, because she was live streaming while this was going on, she started around, 10:30 or so live streaming, and she says throughout the night, what they're saying on the news is just not true. There are gunmen, multiple gunmen, and they're being hunted by the police. She even shows in some of this footage, you can see SWAT walking around as she's kind of looking through the, where you can see. hours after this shooting is supposed to be done, what we hear and see in these video clips from two different employees is the police and SWAT units that were in this area rounding everyone up and moving them down into that Michael Jackson One theater. And the video footage shows at least hundreds of people. One of them in the video says there were thousands, but because the theater was left dark, they kept the lights off. The law enforcement kept all the lights off. You can't really see for sure how many people, but you can see, you know, a thousand little dots all over the room as people are checking out what's going on, what the media is saying. Well, the witnesses that put out these this footage, they give the time as they go along. They're talking, they're narrating. And what you hear on some of the police scanners of the cops that are walking around, you hear them hours after Paddock was already dead, hours afterward, they're still hunting for a shooter who they believed was on the fourth floor.
Jake, I have recordings from that night of just what you're speaking about from the live feed of the EMS, whatever you'd call that. But yes, I can confirm what you're saying.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah,
I just want to mention that. So just to verify that,
And there's also recordings of reports of men on with guns on the runway at the Las Vegas airport.
McCarran Airport, yeah. McCarran Airport.
The airport,
yeah.
And right now, among the information that I put out also during this time, actually backing up. Prior to when, it's kind of been established that the time of the major gun volley started at 10:05 p.m. That's what the final word from the sheriff's department has been, and most citizen investigators kind of agree based on analysis of the different cell phone footage that it was 10:05 p.m. Well, among the witnesses that came forward was a man who spoke with me and showed me the timestamp on his cell phone, sent me a screenshot of it, from 9:55 p.m. His friend, he was staying at the Delano Hotel, a friend of his left to go join another party. She went down the elevator, out to the Delano Valet, got picked up, and had headed out Mandalay Bay Road out to where it meets Las Vegas Boulevard. While she was at that intersection, it was heavy traffic, waiting for the lights to change and so forth, she heard gunshots taking place, and she looked out and saw men who were carrying guns. And so she kind of ducked down. She called her friend and said, "Hey, there are gunmen down here. Stay in your room." And again,
this is street level.
This is between... this is out around Las Vegas Boulevard on kind of between the Luxor Hotel and the concert venue, the Route 91 concert venue. And she sees these men going across the street with guns after she has heard some gunfire. The source that gave me this information heard these gunshots as well, some of them, after she had called in. And so she jumps out of the car and heads to the Luxor, where later on you can hear on the police scanner, you can hear the police talking about how there had been a report of a man with a gun inside one of the Luxor bathrooms there, restrooms. So there were definitely people on the ground moving into place, popping off some of these individual single shots prior to the major volley. Whether or not those specific people were among the ones that they were hunting inside the Mandalay Bay complex, I can't say. It seems like there were multiple people in this team that was working this strip. But going back to the one in the Michael Jackson Theater, you can hear on the police scanner audio there, and the police talking among themselves and telling the people as they're moving, they're very serious, they're telling them, get in the theater. They keep the doors locked from the inside so that nobody outside the theater can open the doors and come in. And the law enforcement, they're yelling at the people, get in, stay away from the hallway there, stay away from the doors. In one, I guess, segment of it, you hear the police yelling, this is still an active situation. There are people still out there. And again, this is, at that point, this is after 1 a.m. This is around 1:30 in the morning, Vegas time. So it's well beyond the time even that SWAT had breached the room 135 on the 32nd floor, that they're still hunting. And so you hear in these videos, you can hear the people talking to each other, the civilians and, you know, the Mandalay Bay shop employees talking amongst each other about this hunt for the shooter. The police had, they finally finished clearing the fourth floor, verified there was nobody there at that point. But they were still looking for someone. And the testimony of these witnesses, which people can see for themselves in the video footage that I posted, they are saying, we know that there are multiple shooters. The police are telling us that they're still looking for shooters. Plus, we've got the witnesses who said that they heard the gunshots around the casino. Whether or not the person, the body face down in the casino was shot or not, we don't know. I do have someone that's reached out to me and says that he is going to deliver to me footage from a different angle of that body. He says the person looks like their body had been dragged forward based on the clothing being pulled up over the head. It's not someone that was just complying with law enforcement orders to get down on the ground or something like that. Someone who I haven't seen that footage yet, so I can't verify that for sure. Well,
just to be clear, are you referencing the body of ostensibly a Paddock? Is that what you're referencing?
No.
All right. So
Paddock would have been up on the 32nd floor. There is some cell phone footage that someone had sent to Laura Loomer, and she put it out. And after she put it out, I saw it, but I had met Laura.
Okay. I'm sorry. I know what you're talking about. The casino footage, the lower half, the legs.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, we actually had her on the day that she released that.
Okay.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. She and I, and a couple other people had actually sat around a table inside the Luxor watching this footage, trying to decide, you know, do we put it out or not, or how to do it, because it doesn't show the top half and you just can't see a whole lot to really know.
Right.
Hopefully this footage does get sent to me that shows it from a different angle and we can get more information on that. The strange thing though, for those that were inside the Michael Jackson Theater, and again, this is hundreds and hundreds of people that are in there, while they're in there, law enforcement at one point yells at everyone to get down. And there are a couple videos that have been put out by different people in the theater showing the aftermath of this. Everyone in the theater gets down on the ground, again, after 1 in the morning, because someone was trying to get into the theater. Whether or not it was a gunman, we don't know. We just know there was panic, and the cops are racing around because they still at that point believe there were multiple gunmen. At the end, though, after keeping everyone in there for hours and hours all through the night, not letting them go, when they finally deemed that it was safe for them to leave, semi-safe, they wouldn't let them go back to their own vehicles. The employees couldn't go back to the parking garage, couldn't go back into the casino area. For whatever reason, they wanted all of that locked off. Remember, this is not supposed to be a crime scene area. I guess technically the whole hotel would have been a crime scene, but they wouldn't let them leave that direction. What they did was they took hundreds of these people out the side door toward the side that Mandalay Bay Road is on, and they put them on buses, and they transported all of the people to what is it? It's something and Mac. It's a big convention center where they have sports events and things like that. Big Coliseum about 15 minutes away from the Strip. That's where they took everybody. And again, this is all on the video footage. Very strange. The employees that were doing these videos found the whole thing bizarre. They didn't understand it. They were frustrated that the truth of what was going on, that the hunt for a shooter was still ongoing, while Sheriff Lombardo hours previously had told the public, there's nothing else. There's no other shooters. All these other reports of gunmen elsewhere, it's all unconfirmed, not true, no evidence of it. That's not what the police were doing. Now, when I first went out to Vegas, I'm in North Carolina. When I went out to Vegas to do some investigation on the ground there, I talked with six police officers. It was all off the, kind of off the record. They didn't want to be quoted, anything like that. But I can characterize, the nature of what they said. And all of these people said the same thing, independent of one another. And that was that they believed that there were multiple shooters around the strip. Whether or not these other shooters were actually firing live rounds is, nobody knows for sure.
Okay, when you say firing live rounds, that would suggest you're talking about, wouldn't it?
Right. Right. That's part of this that's confusing. I have been very slow to buy into the theory that there may have been any kind of crisis acting or anything embedded in all this. The problem that I'm having, though, is I have spoken to so many witnesses now who say, without any question, they could smell a very, just overwhelming, one of them said the air reeked of gunpowder inside.
Yeah.
Inside the hotel complex there, not up anywhere near the 32nd floor, not out near the doors that might lead out, but well inside these corridors between the Mandalay Bay Casino and the Delano, and in the elevator bank around the Delano. They could smell it there. One of the men who told me this, he owns several guns. He likes to go out into the desert doing, shooting of different things, excursions out there for fun. And, says, I know what gunpowder smells like. The problem is there's a complete lack of forensic evidence showing that bullets hit anything. We don't see dings in the walls. We're not seeing any, not finding shell casings inside these particular locations where they're smelling the gunpowder. So.
Right.
Could it have been something? We know in 2016 there was a huge drill they did using a gunman that went in firing blanks in the Las Vegas City Hall. This would have been summer of 2016. I put that video out as well. As far as it actually happening, you can't, a civilian certainly can't tell the difference between a live round or these blanks in the heat of the moment. So whether the reason that I'm open to the idea that these were blanks being fired is because one of the police officers that I spoke to said that the concern that the local PD had was that they were trying to draw the police into these different locations, not only to allow the people or person at Mandalay Bay to get away, but the police were concerned that they were trying to draw them to other places where there were snipers in place that could shoot the police. It didn't turn out to be the case. The police weren't being shot at, by knowledge, at these other locations. But at least that's what I was told was what they feared in the moment. They knew, as they were going around, and you mentioned the police scanner, you can hear them going around being called to the Bellagio and different locations to after reports of gunmen. But they get there and they can't find anything, so they just radio back that it's clear. But what they don't say on the scanners is what the police had told me privately, and that was their concern in the moment, while this was going on, was that they were being manipulated. Very, very clearly there were more people in this operation than just Stephen Paddock.
Okay.
That we can say for sure.
Hold that thought. I just want to mention, we're going to forego the bottom of the hour network break. I want to thank Global Star Radio Network for your cooperation in that. And our guest is Jake Morfonius, End Times News. On YouTube.
Report.
And at Morfonius on Twitter. And you can, the links are in the program description. A very measured analysis as a very good, grounded, measured investigative analysis by our guest, who had spent some time and expended some shoe leather at Ground Zero at Las Vegas. So go ahead, sir, and continue. By the way, just as a point, I guess, to kind of a central point, here's my belief in a nutshell, and you can comment or you can disagree. And if you disagree, I'm open. I'm definitely open to any kind of nudging in any different direction. But in a nutshell, my assessment at this moment in time, this has got proprietary or black ops. There's some connection to the intelligence community with respect to Paddock. Okay, whether or not, regardless of Paddock's involvement, I believe there's also an ISIS or Islamic component to this. Maybe not on the ground, but certainly indicative of the planning or operational aspects of some of this that we're seeing. In fact, you mentioned this going after the first responders as kind of a second wave of attacks. So those two things. Thirdly, I don't believe anything I'm being told. and we have seen nothing. And for this being the biggest, the largest mass shooting in American history in modern times, and of course, aside from Waco, I get that. Okay, so don't send me any more emails about that.
No evidence.
Yeah, right. But this has yet to be exploited by the very people you would expect for gun control. That makes me extremely suspicious. With that, we'll turn it back over to you.
Yeah. No, I agree completely with the points that you made. We speculate here based on what we have on Stephen Paddock that he was involved in something more than just being a gambler who became disgruntled and for who knows what reason decided to attack people. When I had gone out to Vegas, one thing that I did was investigate stories related to his home in Mesquite. On Babbling Brook Court. Mesquite is about an hour and 15 minutes if you go up I-15 heading northeast from Vegas. I stayed at the Virgin River Casino in Mesquite, and that's one of the casinos that he frequented there in Mesquite. It's roughly 10 minutes from his Mesquite home. What I did was I got information from actually some of the real estate agents who had remembered dealing with Paddock because it took a little while for him to purchase the home that he did. It goes back to late 2014 he had gone in. What these real estate agents say they distinctly remember is that he was very open. He was kind of braggadocio in his talking about how much money he had, that he was a professional gambler, that he just had tons of money. And so they went around taking him to see different properties, but he was very, very specific in what he wanted. More than any, he didn't care about the floor plan of the house. He didn't care about the price of the house. What he cared about more than anything was a private location. And so when they finally found this thing up on the Babbling Brook Court, this is up on a hilltop. It's a cul-de-sac, only a couple houses around, not many houses around. House wasn't very big, about very few people around. Well, what Stephen Paddock did as soon as he moved in, and this is all confirmed by his neighbors, first thing that he did after he got this house, which was already kind of secluded and private in its location, was he put up a great big security fence. Oh, and by the way, he paid for that house in cash. It was $369,000 that he paid in cash. And he listed on his application for the home, for the home sale, that his occupation was a gambler. Well, and you just don't make that kind of money from video poker.
No way.
So what he did was he put up this great big solid mesh privacy screen around the property. It was unsightly. It was ugly. And immediately the neighbors were like, what is this guy doing? He just moved here. We've got this great view. And he puts up this great big privacy screen around the property. So they complained. They kind of had their own little homeowners association, and they ordered him to take it down. So the next thing that he did was he had his windows tinted almost black, very dark. One of the neighbors has gone on record saying that he found that Paddock was so unusual that he actually snooped around Paddock's house, kind of would go up there and glance in. He said that the house had almost no furniture in it, that it didn't seem like a house that somebody was trying to live in. But it was kind of a base for him. what we also know is, at least if the FBI, what they're, and the Sheriff's Department, if what they're telling us is true, is when they went and checked that house after the shooting, they found, of course, there were more guns. They found a lot of explosive material, the tannerite, also ammonium nitrate, which is used in terrorist bombings all over the world. It was even, that was used in the Ryder truck that was, part of the, Oklahoma City. Yeah. Bombing.
Also New York City, there was an explosion that the explosives were linked to.
Right. So he's essentially using this Mesquite property as like a, you know, a personal armory and explosives storehouse. Well, that same kind of strange behavior has been confirmed by people who knew him in other locations, like in, I think it was Melbourne, Florida. A neighbor there said that, yeah, he came in maybe four times or so in a two-year period, had virtually no furnishings in the house. It was just kind of a base. He wanted his privacy with some kind of a base. Well, Stephen Paddock, his behaviors there, the explosive material, all this stuff, what I started doing was looking at the rental car records. Someone sent me, someone inside who works for the Phoenix Airport and also Las Vegas Airport, they're the rental car agencies, sent me some information, screenshots and stuff I probably shouldn't have, of his rental car history so that I could try and track his movements here to see if he was either involved in something like ATF gun running, you know, another Operation Fast and Furious or Operation Wide Receiver, something like that, where they're moving AR-15s, stuff like that around. Well, something very interesting turned up. First of all, back in Las Vegas, we learned that not only had he been there at least prior to September 19th, he was already in Vegas staying at different hotels, had multiple rooms booked, had one at the Delano, had one at Mandalay Bay. Well, on the 19th at 3:05 p.m., his Visa card, we've got the receipt for this, Visa card was used to rent an intermediate-sized vehicle at the Sky Harbor Airport in Phoenix. What he had done was he flew, I've even got the flight information, he flew from Las Vegas while he was checked in Las Vegas. He flew to Phoenix, rented a car, and then drove it back to Las Vegas. You know, that's a long drive. About a 4.5 hour drive. It's 297 miles. So he got there, rented this car, and showed back up 10 hours later, which means that we've got roughly 5 hours or so unaccounted for. Where something?
Wait a second. You originated this information? Because I was looking who to cite on this. Okay, but you verified this.
I don't know who put the rental car receipt out originally. No, but I was the first one to put some of this together. Okay. About his movements there and all that.
Great job. I know now I understand how you fit in because I was doing some research and okay, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to clarify that. Go ahead.
Well, what he did was he got back to Vegas at 12:51 in the morning, dropped the rental car off. So we've got this time period of about 5 hours where we don't know what he was doing, but obviously, if you're going to fly from Vegas to Phoenix, rent a car and drive back, that's because either has something or someone that they don't want or cannot put on a flight back. Whether that would be some of the explosive material that was found in his car in the parking garage at the Mandalay Bay parking garage or not, I don't know. It's just speculation. But the behavior and tracking all of this kept me looking, and during the investigation, what I did was I started taking his vehicle history, his own personal cars that he had purchased, to see if I could find anything there related to that. And that's when it gets into the links to these people in Caliente and Panaca, Nevada. Back from there are these people, and I don't know if you guys have ever had anyone on the show that covered any of this. There were a couple
of
people.
No, we haven't.
Pharmacists in Caliente, kind of a small place, even smaller than this little town, Panaca, about 15 minutes away. This is where there's a pharmacy owned by a man named Adam Katschke. And he had lived for a while in Provo, Utah, moved from Provo to this Caliente area and owned this pharmacy. He had a woman named Angela Walker who was working as his pharmacy manager. Now, she did have a pharmacy tech license, but she wasn't qualified legally to be an actual pharmacy manager. What they were doing was they were moving between 2014 and late 2016. They were selling massive amounts. I mean, tens of millions of dollars worth of ketamine product through this pharmacy. And ketamine, for those that don't know, its street name is Special K. Started out, it's mostly used as an animal, like a veterinarian anesthetic, but it's also used as a date rape drug. You can take it, you can snort it, you can smoke it. There's just all kinds of ways that you can use ketamine. Well, this pharmacy manager was defrauding the U.S. government through Medicaid orders. They were out selling this stuff, massive amount of this stuff. At first, they were selling it, getting the money for it, billing Medicaid and getting paid. They kind of got in a little trouble for that, so they had to get a different source to get all of this ketamine because they're moving. And it's, you know, it's psychologically addictive. It's not as physically addictive as other drugs, but it's a huge problem. But a lot of ketamine was coming in across the border, being trafficked along with other drugs from some of the Mexican cartels. And anyway, they were taking this ketamine and they were just sending it out to people, getting people lots of this drug. So in early 2017, both of these people from the pharmacy ended up getting convicted. They're now felons, they're in prison. But here's the interesting thing. The name Adam Katschke had been in my mind and I couldn't remember why. And then I remembered the old vehicle records. Stephen Paddock, when he was still living back in Reno, he put Adam Katschke on as a co-owner of one of his vehicles. I think it was a 2007 Xterra. So their names were on the title of a car. And this is despite them being like 7 to 10 hours apart from each other. Geographically, both their names were on this. And then there was a second car that Paddock sold to this Katschke fellow, and then the original car, that Xterra, they transferred the title to this other woman, Angela Walker, who was the de facto pharmacy manager. So why did Stephen Paddock co-own a car, a vehicle, with this guy that ended up going to prison for the pharmacy fraud? So I started looking into this, and I actually went to an auto dealership, had the guy look at these records with me, because I'm no expert on vehicle titles, but he said, nope, it doesn't make sense, but that's the situation. They were Adam Katschke and Stephen Paddock, both had their names on the same title for this car, and there was a second car later on, like I said. So Stephen Paddock has some connection to these people that ended up going to prison for the ketamine distribution. And so that to me was quite significant. But when you add to that, and this is something I'm still working on, in Panaca, in 2016, I think it was, there was a huge bombing that took place. There was a car bomb. There was a man named Jones who drove a car to a house, called the family and said, get out of the house. It was the name of the family that lived in the house were the Cloughs. And then he set off this car bomb, and this thing, the debris went up to a mile away. I mean, it was big news. It obliterated the house, damaged other houses. An unusual thing is the next door neighbor of the Cloughs was the brother of Adam Katschke. So the guy Jones had previously been fired from a local hospital system. He had been working there and apparently had some issues with either stealing drugs or doing something with drugs. And so they fired him, and he lost his whatever the license is to be able to work in the hospital system there. So we've got here Stephen Paddock linked to this ketamine distribution operation, or at least to the individuals. We've got a major bombing that seems to be connected to the Kachkis as well in some way. They're in this tiny little town of Panaca where all this is happening. And then we've got Stephen Paddock going to Phoenix and other places in this area, renting cars, moving something around. So Stephen Paddock was involved in something, whether it was drug running or gun running or both. I can't say for sure yet, but I do have interviews this week, that I'm doing with people who used to be friends with this Kachki family and, their friends. What they've told me already is that the public, even law enforcement, seems to not know the full extent of what these people were doing, that it was a major operation, that they were involved in some very, very bad stuff, well outside of just drug sales. So I'm hoping to get that information and vet it, and then produce some videos this coming week on that.
And you've done this is just, you know, great in-depth work into the background, and this is one of the areas where so little information has come out. You know, usually when we see the mass shootings like this, just take the latest, the Texas church shooting, you have, you know, old high school buddies and co-workers coming out talking about the character of the person who carried out the attacks. In yeah. this Las Vegas instance, we have just very, very general and vague background info on some of Paddock's employment records, you know, going back to the post office and whatnot. Aside from his brother, you have nobody coming out saying that they were friends with him, that they knew him, even though he was well established there. You got nobody coming out, you know, saying, except the neighbors saying, you know, they see him come and go here and there. It's just a complete drought of information. And it has been like that. And it's definitely something very odd with this case. And I think you are onto something. Whatever his involvement was, it seems to be tied into some sort of criminal activity, and who he was conducting that for is still a mystery. And maybe that's why we have so much secrecy surrounding this, because maybe it was, you know, more of an official capacity right. than not. But it's amazing stuff.
That's the working theory here that I'm looking at is, it's just the fingerprints of some intelligence agency or something like the ATF. It's so similar. Everything about Stephen Paddock that I'm seeing matches up perfectly. It's kind of like Stephen Paddock to me is kind of like Walt from Breaking Bad. He's a guy, you know, he's a guy that just gets in over his head and becomes a big fish and gets a little bit out of his own depth. And I think they knocked him off in the end. I think he was used. I think that Stephen Paddock was dirty. I don't think he got his millions of dollars from gambling. I think that he was a type of Barry Seal character who was doing some dirty work for dirty agencies with the U.S. government.
Those were my exact, based on my own analysis, my exact words. Now, as a licensed investigative agency, we've got that, where I'm not talking internet databases, you know, I'm not talking about the what you find on the internet. I'm talking about databases where you can actually pull down histories that are exclusive to law enforcement investigators. And having said that, the reason I mention this is because right after this happened, I did pull down a database profile of Paddock, and I could tell that it had to be either right after, and I'm talking like as soon as he was identified, within minutes, this database and others associated with this, because we've got multiple companies that we use, was expunged or was altered. The dates did not, I mean, the dates suggest that it was altered. So, yeah, it seems like a legend here that maybe needed to be tweaked to fit a specific narrative. So, but what you said with respect to the vehicle ownership, you know, perhaps I should compare, because we've got a vehicle ownership going back to, I think, 98, or even in the mid-90s. Maybe we should compare some notes here. Maybe whatever we have might help you, or vice versa. But go ahead. Keep going.
Yeah, this is good. Absolutely. Yeah, the one that he, I just looked it up here. He was a registered co-owner of a 2007 Nissan Xterra SE.
Yep.
With Adam Katsky. That's the one. Yeah, and Angela Walker, I think that's the one that she eventually got, ownership of. You know, it's a huge coincidence. I'm okay with, if in the end it were to turn out that this is just a, one of those weird cosmic coincidences, so be it. But, you know, we've got this guy, Stephen Paddock, supposedly the, you know, greatest mass shooter in U.S. history, who is selling multiple cars, trading titles with people who are now in prison for a multi-million dollar illegal drug operation. I don't know. It's more of a conspiracy theory to me to say that there's not something here than to say that, you know, it just doesn't make sense. And given that the intelligence community is working so hard to scrub his history, there's something to it, and they're trying to hide it. And I think that they don't want another Operation Fast and Furious type thing coming out. I think that there was a huge black eye, and they're going to do anything they need to keep that from coming out. While, of course, there are multiple other issues going on here, lots of different motives. I'm not seeing a single thing. It seems like there is a number of things going on, and I certainly have not ruled out at this point the ISIS angle and some of the others.
From a tactical point of view, that's what I'm early on. I had two contacts, but one specific contact that said there was some, I want to be clear here, ISIS related documents that were found. I'm not sure whether they were found at the hotel or at one of his homes or in his car. I'm not sure where it was found. But speaking or addressing the operational tactics of a mass shooting. Now, that's fine. Put that aside for a moment. I'm still unclear as to why would this guy, or what was the motive of him shooting up the target? The target selection to me is interesting. And also the Saudi aspect, given the fact that the four floors up owned by the Four Seasons on, you know, Bin Talal or who is it that owned the
Prince Alawid.
That owned that. And the events in Saudi Arabia right after this. I find all of that curious. So at any rate, there's a lot here to digest and go through. And again, I really respect and admire your measured approach to all of this and your very deliberate incremental dissection of the events and the facts. Please continue.
I was going to say, from the very beginning, before I really saw any evidence, I'll tell you one thing that I heard that I found very interesting. When I was out there in Las Vegas, I was actually approached. I was out live streaming. I had just finished up a live stream, had my camera set up. I was out in the parking lot. I had a big casino sign in the background as a backdrop. There had been some people in a pickup truck off to the side watching. And when I got done, they came over and talked with me and told me what's, at first I just thought it was an outrageously ridiculous story. I didn't believe it, but I have since come to believe it. They said that they were walking around the area of the Hard Rock Cafe, there in the intersection where New York, Mandalay, Tropicana, all of that is there at that intersection. Excalibur's on the other corner. Well, they were there, and they said that they were going through a tunnel in that area. There was a homeless guy who was kind of shifty and said, you know, hey, come over here. Now, I can tell you, the man that I was talking to, he looks very much like, he looks like a stereotypical gun owner. I know that's not a fair thing to say, but, you know, he looks like ex-military. He looks like a kind of guy that would be interested in guns, let me put it that way. Well, this homeless guy said, hey, let me show you something. He had a black case. He opens up this black case, and in the case are a bunch of different guns, including a Taurus Judge, which is the gun that Paddock supposedly shot himself with, and some others. He said, hey, I'll give you a good deal on these guns. So the guy I talked to said, well, where'd you get these guns? What he said was that the homeless man said, well, it's a crazy story, but I was up the street earlier on the day of the Las Vegas shooting. He said that there was a man that had a white vehicle. He said the guy looked like a mercenary, is how he described it. He said he looked like a merc. Said that this guy was taking these black cases two at a time out of this vehicle, going off somewhere, coming back, getting a couple more, and then going again. And so this homeless guy, looking for a, you know, seeing that the vehicle was unsecured at one point, ran up, grabbed one of these black cases, and took off, not knowing yet what was in it, but assuming that he could sell something in there or use it for himself. And that's when he discovered that there were guns. So I have heard, I kind of discounted that at first. I thought, oh, it's an interesting story. I believe the guy telling me, he sounded like, you know, didn't seem like he was lying. But at the time, this was before I had really keyed into the fact that there were operations going on up and down the strip outside of just the Mandalay Bay spot. And one of the sources that I talked to has given me more information on this, and I have every reason to believe, based on all the different witnesses that I've spoken to, there were other people in this operation.
And Jake, I don't mean to cut you off, but we're going to have to have another, we're going to have you back on. And folks, go to End Times News Report on YouTube. That's End Times News Report. And make sure you subscribe. There are all the videos, and it's great detail, great information. Jake, thank you so much for coming on. Sorry we ran out of time, but
that's
we look
great.
Forward to having
and
you back
I'm gonna
on.
I'm going to be in contact with you off air, by the way. All right.
Very good.
All right. When we come back, Stan Dale will be our guest for our third and final hour on this Tuesday. Don't go anywhere.